Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
This episode of Amateur Traveler is sponsored by AutoSlash. AutoSlash may be the best way to find the lowest possible rate when you rent a car. They'll help you find the best rate and then will continue to look for an even better rate in case it goes down. AutoSlash.com. I got my bags packed on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo. Amateur Traveler, episode 603. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about horses and two-humped camels, deserts and steppes, Genghis Khan and yurts, as we go to Mongolia. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. We'll hear more from our sponsor, AutoSlash, in a bit, but first, let's talk about Mongolia. I'd like to welcome to the show Patricia from TheWanderingFrogs.com or TheWanderingFrogs.com. I'm sorry, I can't say that without a cheesy French accent, who has come to talk to us about Mongolia. Patricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me today. And there is nothing cheesy. We're French-born, so we're all about cheese. So
it's cheesy when I see it. So fortunately, yeah. We're going to talk about Mongolia while I will be less tempted to drop into a cheesy French accent. You are recently back from Mongolia. You were there last November, as I understand. What led you to Mongolia?
This was a dream country for me. I've been horseback riding when I was little, and so any destination that features horses is high on my list. And this was actually the first trip on our world trip, and so we decided to go and spend a couple of time in that wonderful country. The reason why we want to go there is because of the stunning landscape, and we love the outdoors, but also very specific thanks to its nomadic lifestyle. Anyone who is interested in the great scenery and wants to learn about some of the few nomadic people out there in the world, then Mongolia is the place to go.
We've done another show on Mongolia, but it's been a long time ago. And we did it with Chris from Atlanta, who went there to take pictures of the wild horses. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes if people are interested. And I know of people who have gone to Mongolia for the horses, both in that show and then after listening to that show, we've definitely sent other people there. So you are not alone in being attracted by the horse culture in Mongolia. And what kind of itinerary would you recommend? I know you spent a couple months there, but we're going to boil that down to the essential week or 2 week that you would recommend for somebody with shorter vacation time.
There's definitely a couple of itineraries you can do for 1 week or 2 weeks, but I will go to the one that is kind of the more traditional one and gives you a good idea about what Mongolia is about. This is basically starting with Ulaanbaatar, which is Mongolia's capital. And then from there, you would go to the Gobi Deserts and spend a couple of days in the Gobi Desert. The distances are huge in Mongolia, so this is something you have to keep in mind when you build your itinerary. And then you would go to central Mongolia to see the city of Karakorum, which is Karakorum in English, which is the city that was built by Genghis Khan. And the city has been destroyed, but some of the temples are still there and are definitely worth visiting. And there are a couple of things you can do around the area and then back to Ulaanbaatar. So that's about a 7 days a week type of itinerary.
Excellent. And now we'll go through that in a little more detail. You had us flying into Ulaanbaatar, and what would we do and see while we're in the capital city?
Many people actually skip Ulaanbaatar, but I personally think this is worth visiting for a day, not only just to recover from the jet lag, but a couple of interesting sites that we like were the 19th century Gadan Tek Chiling Monastery. It has one of the tallest statues in a Buddhist temple, so it's worth visiting. We really liked also the Choling Lama Temple Museum. It's a tiny museum downtown Ulaanbaatar, but the different small temples, very highly decorated. And another one that I like is the Winter Palace of the Bogdkhan, which is a bit outside the city, but it was one of the last palaces by the officials in Mongolia before the country, after the wars, when the communists came in the country. The buildings are very nicely decorated, lots of greens. It's actually known as the Green Palace because of the tiles. You can also go to the black market, which is called the Naran Tool Market.
sorry, the black market?
Yes. Yeah, it's called the black market because the many things are sold, I guess, on the black market.
Okay.
And it's an interesting market in the sense that you get to see how the local lives, and you can buy from the vegetables to your furniture to your saddle to your sunglasses. So it's kind of a mishmash. It's not necessarily, it's not your souvenir type of market. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's the real deal. And then one last place I would go for a stroll is the Genghis Khan / Subakar Square. It used to be called Genghis Khan, but it's been renamed since then, so hence the two names. It's a big plaza, and you have a couple of statues of Genghis Khan and his two sons. And it's just nice just to go there and watch people. In summertime, you also have festivals there. You wouldn't spend a lot of time, but it's nice just to walk around. So plenty to do, more than to do in one day. So pick and choose. But this is why I think Ulaanbaatar deserves to be visited as part of the Mongolian itinerary.
Well, and you mentioned Genghis Khan. We've mentioned him now twice. And I'm going to recommend you do a little reading up on Genghis Khan before you go. I'm actually going to recommend a book that I really quite enjoyed, which is Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But it's quite an amazing story, really. Both brutal and at times inspiring, too. It's hard to say that in the same sentence, but there is quite an interesting history as you talk about somebody who is a boy who, according to the secret history of the Mongols, was outcast from his clan and then ended up ruling much of the world. So.
Yeah, and the Mongols are very proud of Genghis Khan. They keep mentioning it. They supposedly found where it would be buried, but part of the burial hasn't been disclosed, and they keep the area protected. No one is allowed to go there because they want to make sure that wherever that might be, if it's the true area where it was buried, it stays untouched. And so it's all that kind of legacy that the Mongols are very, very proud of.
Excellent. And then you had us go to the Gobi Desert next.
Yes.
Are we driving to the Gobi or are we flying? You mentioned the distances are large.
Yes, they are large. And driving is the way to do it. I mean, it's going to be a long day, but you get to see some nice scenery on the way. Mm-hmm. You can either take public transportations, which is the real deal, but with short on time, probably rent a car and a driver, which means that you have a bit more flexibility on the road there. And then you can stop in a couple of places if you want to take photos. And so once you arrive in the main town over there, you would start the trip into the Gobi proper.
And you say the main town. I don't think I remember what the main town is.
It's Dalansabad. And it's the highways has been built to that city in the last couple of years, just because it's part of that main hub to the Gobi Desert.
Okay.
And so once you're in Gobi, you can spend 1 or 2 days in the Gobi Desert. You have a couple of different sites to see. The two major ones, one is the Flaming Cliffs. It's also called Bayan Zadag. So you can picture a bit the Grand Canyon, but smaller. And more importantly, you can go and search for dinosaurs' eggs and bones. This is one of the sites where they found some remaining of the dinosaurs. We went for a hike, which is lovely. Spent a couple of hours there. We didn't find any dinosaurs. I think I thought I found some, but my husband said no way. So, you know, it's open for discussions and let your imaginations go. I'm still thinking I found one, but anyway. And then the other one are the famous Kongorin Els sand dunes, which are the largest and the most impressive sand dunes in Mongolia. They spread over 8 miles in width, about 60 miles in length, and they have some of the tallest dunes in the area. Some of them go about 1,000 feet high. So definitely a must. Those are kind of the two musts here I would recommend in the Gobi Desert.
And the Congorian Else, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is sometimes called the singing sands, I'm seeing.
That's right, the singing sands. So we didn't hear them sing.
Okay.
From what I understand, it's where it's actually windy. The wind actually picks up the sound, and then by blowing the sands, make it sing. The day we were there, there was no wind. It was scorching hot, and I would have wished a bit of wind, but no, we didn't get any of that.
Now, you say scorching hot, and we're there in November, so you're there in late autumn.
Yes, and we were there about in the morning, so it was kind of like getting by the time. So we hike from the bottom of the dune to the top, which is pretty tough. I mean, we're hikers, and but here it's actually going up, up, up on the sand.
Sure.
I was on my knee most of the time because it was so steep, and you go up one step and you go down two. But the view from there is just, it's fantastic. It's the desert and it's beautiful. So I would totally recommend that.
And you're in a national park when you're there.
Yes.
I don't know that I can pronounce it here, but we're in the Gurvan Sai Khan National Park. Am I close?
You're close. I mean, it's a bit of a mouthful, so yes.
Okay.
There is no sign usually when you go. It's not like in the US when you go into a national park where you see it's all enclosed, or you go in the entrance. It's basically the Gobi Desert is just open space. There is no map. When you drive there, there is no sign. So that's why having a driver, you make sure they know where they're going. There are a couple of those national parks in the Gobi area.
Let's take a break here and hear from our sponsor. Again, the sponsor of this episode is AutoSlash. AutoSlash is going to help you find a rental car at a good price by not only searching across different rental car companies, but also searching for different discounts that would be available through AAA, Costco, AARP, credit cards, frequent flyer programs, and all those things. They're going to check literally hundreds of coupons and discount codes, which I don't know about you, but I don't have time to do that myself. And then after it helps you find the best available rate, it's going to continue to look for price drops and better deals. If it finds a lower rate, then it will email you so you can take advantage of the savings. It's like price protection for your rental. It's almost like having an assistant who is fully dedicated to finding you the best deal on a rental car. I have not used it personally, but I have a friend who has and had a good experience. They say that renters on average save 30% or more using AutoSlash. Check them out. AutoSlash.com. Anything else we want to talk about in the Gobi?
While you're there, you might want to consider riding a camel. It could be more or less touristy. Make sure that the camels are well treated, which is a different topic. But if you find a good outfitter, so to say, then this is quite nice riding the camel per se. But it's also a good way of visiting the dune because you go at a slow pace and you get places that you might not go by yourself, definitely not with a car. Camels are an important part of the nomadic lifestyle. So it's not just something for the tourists. They actually live with their camel.
Well, and our experience from Upper Egypt is that a camel is a whole lot more sure-footed in that sand than you or I are.
Totally, definitely.
So, but these would be Bactrian camels, two hump camels?
I think there were two, yes. Mm-hmm. And this is actually interesting how you sit on that. It's way comfier than the one. Because you're like stuck between two, so not as unstable.
Sure.
But yes.
And then where are we going from the Gobi?
There is a couple of other sites, but there are minor sites. But you might want to stop just for the matter of breaking your journey.
Sure.
Since I was mentioning that's a bit sometime long road. Otherwise, from there, you would go and head to Central Mongolia.
Were you going to tell us what the few minor sites were? Or
there is Yoli Arm. It's like a narrow canyon. It's not bad. I mean, just stop there for a stop, stretch your leg, but don't plan on spending a lot of time. It's a narrow canyon, so you can go for a short hike. Some people are selling like horseback riding, but I would not recommend it because the horses are not necessarily well treated, but you're also just riding for 15 minutes. So compared to the rest of Mongolia, it is rather touristy.
Okay. And you say a narrow canyon. I'm seeing pictures that it's a slot canyon. Narrow as in some places you could touch the walls with both arms reached.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yes. It starts as a wider valley, but then as you kind of hike your way down, it gets narrower and narrower. And then you ended up as there is actually water coming up from like a spring coming up.
Okay.
It's very narrow and you have to kind of get down. So stretch your legs is perfect. If you start with that, you might not be that impressed.
Okay.
From Gobi, you head to Karakorin, which is Karakoram in central Mongolia. This is a long day drive, so what you can do is actually stop on the way to one of the monastery, and it's called the Ongi Monastery. You can spend a couple of hours to visit. There are a couple of places where you can stay there, and it's nice. It's a big site. It's actually two different temples, monasteries. They are slowly reoccupying the monastery because during the war in 1939-40, many of those monks and temples were killed and destroyed. So some of those sites are being rebuilt, and some monks actually starting to come back. So when we were there in that temple, I think at that time they had about 6 or 10 monks that would come and stay and start decorating and rebuilding and then leave and come back. So it's kind of growing back. It's a nice area. There is a river. You can swim in the river, wash out the dirt from the roads. So it's a nice break, and it's not necessarily very popular, but as far as we're concerned, we kind of liked it. And then you reach Karakorin. So Karakorin is obviously famous because it was built by Genghis Khan. As far as I could tell or could read, it was built when he had troops during one of his conquests, had some troops settled there. And then from the settlements, he actually became a city under his son in the 13th century. And so it was the first Mongolian capital, and it was the Mongolian capital until it was built, moved by Kublai Khan, one of the other sons, descendant from Genghis Khan, to Beijing. So it was very, very popular.
Well, and that was after the conquest of China. He moves the capital to China. Yeah.
To China and to what is now Beijing. It's actually funny to think about that. Beijing is so big nowadays, and you try to go to Karakorin, and it's so like such a contrast between what could have been and what is Beijing today. So you don't get to see much of the city per se because that has been destroyed, but you can see the landscape and you can picture how it was back then. But the other part of the visit is spent to the Erdene Zu Monastery, which is a beautiful monastery, also partly destroyed again during the war, but there are still the walls with the white stupas, a couple of very old monastery there, like lots of greens and red and yellow, and it's really nice. And it's still active monastery today. So you still see the monks. There is another building nearby where we went to see the monk chanting and going by their lives. So it's very interesting. And it was important monastery because this is where the Buddhism was declared as Mongolia religion in the 16th century. So kind of like the earliest surviving Buddhist monastery and kind of traditions in Mongolia. It might seem that it's far away when you look at a map and where you would go there just to see a temple, but it's definitely, I would say, one of the things to do and see when you are in Mongolia.
Well, and this is a part of a World Heritage Site, we should mention. Yes. And the other thing, you mentioned that this was built by Genghis Khan or his son, and that it was the first capital. It was also the first city. This is really, we're talking about a people that, as you mentioned, were nomadic, and so they did not have cities. And so it was quite a big change to build basically a city and saying, we're now going to take on some of the habits and customs of the city people that they usually looked down on, as I was reading about Genghis Khan and the Mongols and the Tartars and those people of the steppes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
When you look at the overall map of Mongolia today, you have just a couple of major cities, and the rest is just nomadic. Even more so, like back in the 13th century, that was indeed a big step, a big change in traditions.
Right. Now, obviously, Ulaanbaatar is over 1 million people now, so there's quite a few people who are in Mongolia now who are not nomadic and live much more like, well, I was going to say much more like you and I, much more like me. You are nomadic. You live more like the rest of them. So,
About 30% of the Mongol population live in Ulaanbaatar today, and about 40 to 50%, depending on who you're reading, is still nomadic, and the rest, so it's about, 20 and 30% lives in either other cities like Ogi in Western Mongolia or Dalanzagbat in the Gobi Desert. But yes, it's still a big city in itself, Ulaanbaatar.
Interesting. Anything more we want to talk about Karakorum?
No, so from there, you have a couple of options depending on how you organize your trip, depending whether you have the flexibility of your own driver or not. So you can keep going west to the Orkhon Valley, which is also traditionally a big nomadic area because of the valleys. This is where you have lots of livestock. The valley is home to the Orkhon River, hence the name, and it has a couple of beautiful waterfalls, and you see that huge river across the steppe. So it's very nice. We went there when it was October, so definitely kind of a cooler, but also you get to see the fall colors. So it's not Vermont type of fall colors, but it's definitely still very nice. If you haven't done any horseback riding at any time during your trip, this is also a place where you can go for 1 hour or more, experience riding Mongolian horses yourself.
And if we're doing that, it's real easy. You just drive up and somebody lets you get on their horse, or did you arrange this ahead of time?
No, you definitely arranged. You will be staying in Ger, the traditional Mongolian round tent. When you're there, you can either get through your driver or the people where you're going to be staying and say, like, if you can arrange maybe the day before, but usually horses are never far from any Ger. They might actually go and pick them, but this is what happened when we were there. Some of the people we were with wanted to do horseback riding. Within an hour or so, a horse appeared. So if you want to plan something longer, definitely you need a bit more preparations. But if you just want to go for an hour or two, usually within the day, you probably can arrange something.
Well, and this brings up the issue of language, because I assume you speak at least French and English. We've established one and the other one is more likely, but probably don't speak Mongolian.
Not so much.
So you're doing a lot of communication through your driver who spoke some English?
Yes.
Because usually a driver is not a guide necessarily, and so they're not necessarily fluent in English.
That's right. And so the guide, the drivers that we had probably spoke as much English as I spoke Mongolian.
Okay. seems like a fairly large gap in between there. Okay.
Yes. It's amazing how much you can get through with hand signals.
Sure. Tourist charades.
But
yep.
Our best friends in that case was Google Translate. And okay. we did buy a SIM card, so we had some connections. But
a lot of time you're outside of where
yes.
the yeah.
So you can download applications and have them okay. offline.
Is there one you would recommend that worked best for you?
So I don't remember, but I will definitely look it up and let you know so you can add that later on.
Okay. We'll put a link to that in the show notes so people can check that out when you're listening to the show. We will know that by then.
Yes. So there were definitely a couple of times where it was a bit of a struggle trying to communicate or get up with a bit of a surprise between what you were kind of thinking and expecting and what you're getting.
Okay. You have to tell that story then. What kind of surprises did you end up with then?
Things that we order for food where we were thinking we're going to sleep. And sometime we thought we're going to sleep in one place and we ended up just, it actually turned to be perfect because going to the Orkhon Valley, we stopped in one of the small monastery, which I would also recommend. It's called the Tovkron Monastery.
Okay.
It's high in the mountains and it's in the middle of nowhere. So you actually have to drive over a bridge, cross a few passes. I mean, they're not like high passes, but still like up and down. And then you arrive in the places where you have like literally three gears and you try to communicate with the driver, like, is that where we're staying tonight? Where do we go from there? Because they just stop and expect you to get out of the car and you're just like, what happens now? So basically because we managed to express to them that we'd rather stay with local people than hotel or like guest houses or things. And that we wanted to see like out of the beaten path places. So they took us to that Tovkron monastery, which was beautiful. And we ended up staying in that places where they were not ready for tourists. And they were like people living in their own gear. And they usually have one or two gears.
Okay.
So what happened is that the family just gave us their gear and we slept on the floor. They roll up a few blankets and we all slept at night in their gears. So it turned out to be an awesome evening and sharing the place with them, playing with the kids, and they had horses. I sat with the horses. It's just like an incredible experience. But going back to the language, like, wasn't necessarily what we had discussed or expected. So more goods than bads came up from that kind of lack of communications.
Okay. And so that means for somebody who has a little less flexibility in time, a little more fear of the unknown, maybe getting a guide and the added expense of that might be something that they'd be interested in as well.
Yes. Okay. Because we were kind of like going to the Orkhon Valley, you don't have to stay in that part. It's something we had talked with them. So definitely you can stay more, as much as I would say the regular itinerary. Mongolian being kind of like underdeveloped when it comes to road system and tourism still. Don't expect like your four-star hotel or your, if you're into jacuzzi or things like that, maybe not for you. But there is definitely a couple of places where they are more used to seeing tourists, sure. where they would have potentially a shower, sometime not, or potentially have restrooms, sometime not. So there are definitely, if you're looking a bit more of comforts than totally roughing it, you can still definitely do that. And going back to your point about a guide, one thing, obviously, of us doing that way is that we also miss on some explanations or some understanding. Sure. So this is something, sometimes it's a trade-off, having to go with a guide or without. Looking back, there are some times where I would have liked to have a guide with us because you share a bit more of that and interact a bit more with the locals.
Right. Any other stops?
No. So from there, then I would say it's about your week-long itinerary and it's time to go back towards Ulaanbaatar. There are about 200 miles between Karkarin and Ulaanbaatar, and it's a paved road, but still need to go there. One stop you can do on the way back is the Hostai National Park, mm-hmm. which is where you will see the khaki, the wild khaki horse. They're also called the Prevalsky horses, and they are the only true wild horse on Earth in that that horse has never been domesticated. Hmm. And it's a different species than the other horses as we know it in the US, in Europe, or even different than the other Mongolian horses. They're like differently. When you look at them, you know that they're different. Mm-hmm. They have beige color, so very unique. That horse became extinct in the 60s, but it's been reintroduced slowly in that park.
Became extinct in the wild.
In the wild, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's called Prevalsky is because I believe it was a Hungarian, Mr. Prevalsky, who actually took some of those horses back to, I believe it's Hungary. And so they had a few. So when it became extinct in Mongolia, they actually brought back some of those horses to Mongolia and were able to reintroduce it in the park.
And you were correct. It was Hungary. Interesting.
Okay. You might not see them because like many wild animals, they don't necessarily work on your timetable.
Sure.
Yeah. If you try to go early in the morning or in the evening, you might have a better chance. You can also spend a night in the park if you want to. But we were lucky to see them. We got up, our driver saw something in the further away, and so we stopped there and we hiked a bit, not far, not by no means difficult, but we got to actually see them quite close. They were obviously very cautious of us and for any wild animals, but it's a nice park and I would recommend it. And again, because I'm a horse person, anything with a horse is obviously a must see. So you can either integrate that as part of your return trip from Karkarin, or this is still something you can do as a day trip from Ulaanbaatar. It took us maybe 2 or 3 hours to go. So it's definitely something that you can do.
Excellent.
And that brings you back to Ulaanbaatar.
One thing you haven't talked about is the food in Mongolia. I have had a lot of people tell me that you don't go to Mongolia for the food.
And that's exactly what I would say too. I love Mongolia. I could speak mm-hmm. and talk about Mongolia for hours. I actually would like to go back. We're still in contact with many people in Mongolia, even given the difficulty of the language. But if it's one thing that, yes, is not the most enticing part, is the food. Because they are nomadic people, mm-hmm. they don't grow vegetables, they don't grow fruits, or not much. You'll find a couple of potatoes and cabbage and stuff, but they live off their livestock, which is meaning meat. A couple mm-hmm. of things that you'll eat in Mongolia is specifically around mutton and handmade pasta. And for about a month and a half, we got two versions of that, which is one is served as a soup, noodle soup with some mutton, and the other one is fried. So the same thing, but fried. If you organize something with your own driver, you can maybe plan ahead and have them buy some food ahead of time and make sure that whoever you stay with will incorporate that in the meal. But if you just go by whatever you might find when you stop on by the side of the road, this is usually what they will serve you. A couple of our other options, but we didn't find them that often. It's called the buzz, which is like a steamed dumpling filled okay. with meat. And mm-hmm. then the other one is kushur, which is like a meat pie, but we didn't see them very often. If you like dairy products, then you're in for a treat to some extent. Again, since they have that much livestock, they produce a lot of dairy product themselves. Mm-hmm. It's part of their daily routine. Morning, you go and you milk. Could be the goats, the sheep, the cow, the yak, the camel, the reindeer, depending on which part of Mongolia you're in. And from there, they're going to make their own fresh butter, fresh cream, soft cheese. So you get a lot of that as part of the daily food. And they all do a version of some kind of sun-dried hard cheese called Kurud. So it's basically as they process their milk. We saw that in Western Mongolia in Ogi. We actually watched them every day do different things with the milk. That was really interesting. And one of them, when they have that some kind of soft cheese, they slice it in a small portion and they put that and let them dry under the sun. It becomes very, very hard, like stone hard. And part of it, the reason why they do that is because they don't have fridge, right? So that's how they conserve some product through winter.
Right.
And the way they eat at, so you can either nibble on it, but watch for your teeth because it is very hard. Or the way they do it is that they actually try to break kind of larger pieces and they let it soften in the hot milk. Okay. So Mongolian milk tea is something that you have to experience when you're in Mongolia. So as much as I was talking about the rest of the food, that it's very similar. The Mongolian tea is like a ceremony in itself. Everywhere you go, or most of the time, Mongol people will welcome you and they will have you sit for tea. So the tea is not your kind of regular cup of tea. It's almost a meal in itself. They will serve you with everything they have in the house. Cakes and bread and that butter and the cream cheese and sweets. And if there is space on the table, it's not right. They have to fill with something. And they keep serving you the hot tea. And that's where you can dip the dried cheese and just eat that. And be aware that sometimes if you stay in a yurt, even if you got the Mongolian tea and you're full, usually lunch and dinner come afterwards. So be prepared.
Excellent. What was your biggest surprise with Mongolia?
I think for me, it's like how welcoming the people are. You can say that for many countries, but it's literally true there. We're talking about organizing something or working up a gear and just staying there. It's like if you arrive to a place and they will literally welcome you, even if they don't know you, even if you're not scheduled to be there. How nomadic the life still is. It's something you read about before you go there. But once you're there, you actually see like, yes, they are really nomads. We stayed 1 week with nomads in Ogi in Western Mongolia, and it was kind of the end of summer, and they were starting to pack their things and go to their winter house. And right. We know that they were moving around during summer. And so it's not just something that is a myth. This is how people, I was talking about, I think 50% of the population still lives today. And You drive through Mongolia, you don't see a lot of towns, but you might see a gear here and a gear there and a couple of livestock here. So it means that there is a gear somewhere else. So that was really surprising. And even if you see some modern signs, like here and there, you'll see a solar panels and a couple of cell phones. It's still very traditional. The food is still cooked on a stove. And that's the main thing in a gear. That's your heat source and that's how you cook your food. Because they don't have a lot of wood, they actually use either yak dung or cow dung or camel dung. So at the beginning, it's a bit surprising, but it works, doesn't smell, and that's all you live by. And basically, the other thing that was surprising is actually the Gobi Desert. I was expecting some kind of very mostly sand area.
Oh,
It's not. It's arid, but it's huge. And so it was a bit of a different expectation of what I was thinking what the desert might look like versus what we saw in Gobi. So a lot of things surprised us in Mongolia. All good things. An incredible country.
Excellent. One time you felt closest to home, this is very familiar. And another time you felt furthest from home, this is nothing like what I'm used to.
I would say how we stayed with the family, they made us feel part of home, literally. The first day when we stayed with them was a bit weird because we're the strangers, right? And given the lack of communication, didn't know what to do. But we tried to really incorporate the family. And within a couple of days, we were laughing, like as much as we can laugh again with the lack of communications. And we ended up doing immigration of their livestock with them. So they were really kind of like put us in the house. And when we left the house, the lady that was part of the house, she gave us things. They're small things, but those people, they don't have a lot of things, right? They're kind of poor by our standards. And our husband, who passed away many years ago, was an eagle hunter. And she gave us, she had on display a couple of eagle feather that was our husband's eagle at the time. And she gave us one of the feather. And she gave us a little handkerchief that she herself embroidered a couple of years ago. So they were just like amazing gesture from her and just like how she made us part of the family within that short period of time. And I'm actually just like thinking about that time, just giving me goosebumps just on a side note because it was extraordinary. Time where I felt like as far as away from home as it could be, lacking modern amenities. When you have some needs that you need to go and attend in the morning, and you are in the middle of the steps in within the Altai Mountains, and there is no restroom. The restroom is basically a hole in the ground, which happens in many other places. But here, you literally have just maybe a knee-high plank, three sides, and the rest is open in the open field in a flat country. And yes, so you have a wonderful view, but you're hoping you're not offering a view to anyone else around you. So this is where we like roughing it and we like camping. So we're used to this kind of environment. But I have to say that at that precise moment, and especially when it's kind of winter and you had snow the day before and it's freezing, I have to say that this is the couple of moments where I'm just like, it's as further away from home as it could be in that particular moment.
That's excellent. That is useful information to have. It means that if I ever want to take my wife to Mongolia, I have to make sure she does not listen to this episode. People should hear that. And of course, partially that's because you were staying with locals and had chosen to stay rougher somewhat. But okay, good to know.
And definitely, you know, and it goes back to what I was saying in terms of you can definitely stay in other places where you know, and they will have it's not necessarily going to be luxury.
Yeah.
Sometimes you might have to go without a shower for a day or two, but it's still kind of better organized here because we stay in the family. This is how they live, and so it's just like do as the Mongolian do, right?
Yeah. So you're standing at the prettiest spot in Mongolia. Where are you standing, and what are you looking at?
We went trekking in the Altai Tavanbog National Park in the Altai Mountains, and you've got beautiful glacial river, turquoise water, and you have the blue sky, and you have the green mountains, and you have a couple of yaks around, a couple of wild horses the other side, and it's just you. That was probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in Mongolia. Okay. The scenery in Mongolia is just mind-blowing. It's just crazy beautiful. It's funny how often it can change in the skies. The color is just like, so basically you're staying in one place 1 minute and then you look up again and it feels like you're somewhere else in that same time. So you won't be disappointed by Mongolia.
Excellent. Last two questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Mongolia.
Their love. Basically, we had a couple of issues with our cars and our Russian minivan and things like that. And basically, nothing is impossible in Mongolia. But literally, nothing is impossible. It actually became like a joke with my husband because something would wreck. And then you're in the middle of the night. That actually happened to us. We're driving to see the Tsatan reindeer herders. And we're in that Russian minivan. It's getting dark and it's actually night. And I think our driver was kind of lost, but all of a sudden we broke down. He tries to fix it. And we're just like, okay, we're going to spend the night here. And all of a sudden he just like takes pieces of cables and pieces of wire and literally like just wrap things together and take a tape. And so basically it was for us like nothing is impossible. You can always fix things and you just need to ask for something and people would just make it happen. They laugh at everything. Nothing is a problem, basically.
Excellent. And last question, if you had to summarize Mongolia in three words, what three words would you use?
Open. Open as in the land open. Open as the people, the friendliness. Ego, because a lot of the tradition that we've seen in West Mongolia was through the relation with their eagles and eagle hunting and all that. And horses, because wherever you go, see your horse. Maybe not in the Gobi Desert per se, but otherwise. Mongolian without their horses, I don't think are really Mongolian. I mean, it's kind of an assumption I'm making, but it's like you'll see them with their long, thick coats and their boots and their hats. And somewhere close will be a horse. I was talking about Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital. And in a market, you find saddle, you find everything for your horse. So I don't think you can find any other capital where you might find like horse gear as part of the common things you can buy in a market.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Patricia from, and I'm only going to say this with a cheesy French accent one more time, thewonderingfrogs.com. And Patricia, if we wanted to point people to your best post on Mongolia at thewonderingfrogs.com, what post would we send them to?
You can go to the Gobi Desert since we're talking about that and our experience actually hiking the Gobi Desert. So it's called Gobi Desert Hiking, the Sand Dunes of Kongorin Elves.
Excellent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Patricia, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Mongolia.
And thank you very much for having me. It's been great. And go Mongolia. You will love it.
In news of the community, I heard from Dylan on the episode we did on Crete. I love your podcast. I listened to some episodes several times. Chania is my second home, and we keep going back there every year. Best beaches I have been in are Elafonisi, Balos Lagoon, Afrata, and Saiten Limania. We are based in Agil Apostoli, near Chania, very quiet and filled with small local beaches and traditional taverns. We love it. I loved this episode, but let me just say this because it is bothering me inside. It is Rethymno or Rethymnon, not Rethymmo. So Chris, you are pronouncing it correctly. Greetings from Ireland, Dylan. Yep, Dylan, I stand by my pronunciation. I heard it from the locals there. But I can say that I'm not going to throw any stones about pronunciation. I suspect I just screwed up a bunch right now, and we're constantly screwing up pronunciations on the show as we go from region to region talking about different place names in different languages. It's just an almost no-win situation. And if you don't believe me, just talk to the residents of Cairo, Egypt, and Cairo, Illinois, which are spelled the same, Moscow, Russia, and Moscow, Idaho, and again, spelled the same way in English. And that's ignoring that Moscow, Russia is really Moskva, and I don't even know what Cairo is in the native language. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Check us out on Pinterest, Blog Lovin', and Flipboard. Links to all those at the bottom of the page on amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.